we went through the little town of Argenton, and out on a blackboard, as if they were advertising what the specials of the day at a restaurant or something of the sort, here was it chalked on the blackboard, Parier Libre. And sure enough, it was. That's how we found out about it.
It was at the bulge that Eisenhower's self-confidence really peaked. And he took immediate charge of the situation, began moving around armies on his own, and just had total command of the situation. And from that point until May 8th, when the Germans surrendered, that was the general that Eisenhower was.
It was terrible for the men who were in it, but it probably was Hitler's dying gasp.
I got a call about 4 o'clock in the morning, and Ike on the phone himself, and said, "Oh, Brad, it's all over." And went on to tell me they'd signed an armistice that day, effective at midnight the next day.
General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
The Eisenhower Years, a chronicle in sound of the life of Dwight Eisenhower, produced by Extension Radio Television at Kansas State University. This week, the final thrust, victory in Europe.
By early August of 1944, General Dwight Eisenhower had moved his headquarters from England to France, a tent camp set up in an apple orchard. And from there, the man who commanded all the Allied forces directed the war in Europe. Biographer Ken Davis was a correspondent then, attached to that...
...of people running this enormous war. Everybody felt good in his headquarters, and everybody liked one another, and they worked well together. They were forced to work well together because he insisted upon it. It was a warm kind of friendly feeling in his headquarters. Really, it was. And Ike, this was Ike's influence as much as, or more. A different commander would have been a different kind of headquarters. He could exude a certain kind of warmth and geniality, which was important historically.
General Eisenhower's public relations officer, Thor Smith.
This little camp was just his personal facility. Actually, all there were the general and his aides and secretaries and a little communications team and a little mess team and this little press group that I had. And this was just really just sort of a stopping off place. We were very rarely in camp. General Ike would go and we'd have our own little convoy of about 3 or 4 cars. And he'd go to the various command headquarters practically every day. So we were just constantly on the move, following him, trailing him.
Smith recalls an incident during that time that is yet today frightening in its implication.
General Ike made a tour of the Cherbourg Peninsula with General Bradley. They'd been up to Cherbourg itself, and then after that they came back and they took a look at the first V-2 site that we overran. And there were just a handful of us there at the time. And I'll never forget the total overwhelming amazement of both General Bradley and General Eisenhower when they saw this thing. Because the V-2 installations were not the simple ski run type of thing like the buzz bombs were. This installation, which wasn't completed, incidentally, looked like Boulder Dam under construction. It was huge. They must have been working on it for years and hadn't finished it yet. But they could tell from the way it was, the way it was oriented, where it was supposed to be aimed. And it didn't look as though it was aimed at England. And I can remember General Ike turning to General Bradley and saying, "Brad, we better get our ordnance people over here and take a look at this. Maybe they were aiming at the United States." But it was... It goes to show how little we knew about these things, and this was really a almost a terrifying experience to think that maybe they were building a rocket that could hit the United States.
the Normandy campaign raged through July and into August. Near the end of July, with Montgomery holding fast around Caen, the breakthrough came at St. Lô. By the third week in August, the campaign was over.
Because of the tremendous defense the Germans put in around Caen, we finally had to start from way back at St. Lô and swing from there. But then that swinging around movement was just a whole effort to capture the German 7th Army. Sprung up from the fact that they didn't want to give up that line, so they began to attack right into our hinge. And that gave us a big opportunity, and Bradley, I think, probably thought of the idea first and said, let's swing in closer and capture these fellows right here. And we won't have to fight them on the Seine. And I say, you go right ahead, that's fine. And as we close these armies one on the other, the British on the north and the American coming around from the right, the Germans tried to get out. And, of course, we brought to bear all of our air, all of our machine gun fire and artillery. And, you know, the soldiers began to speak of that as a great killing ground. I think the battle ended, as I recall, about August 16th or 17th. And I went in there about 2 or 3 days later. And during all the acres and acres, it was just nothing but dead. And the scene was even more terrible because of the fact that Germany were using a great deal of horse-drawn artillery. And whole teams had just been killed by the same shell burst and just laying flat there with their guns. And honestly, you could have walked a quarter of a mile without ever stepping on ground. It was a horrible scene. And it was the end of the Normandy campaign. From then on, it was exploitation right up to the Rhine, almost, or up to the borders of Germany.
With the Normandy campaign over, the Allies pushed toward Germany itself, and Eich found himself directing the final thrust of the war in Europe. And while he was busy and constantly on the move, there was time occasionally for relaxation and the company of an old friend, General of the Army, Omar Bradley.
Well, we usually got together at least once a week, either because of his coming to my headquarters or mine going back to his. Sometimes we'd play two or three rubbers of bridge, and we'd sit there and talk till early in the morning about future operations and about personnel. We did play some bridge. And in general, we just spent our time talking over future operations, and I say personnel. I always wanted to, when I sent back a recommendation for some colonel to be made a brigadier general, I want him to know something about this man ahead of time. So I usually talk to him about junior generals and junior colonels, so that when I send back a recommendation for promotion, he could visualize what the man had been doing without my writing out a long letter. And he kept track of the personnel very well.
Eisenhower's aide and longtime friend, Harry Butcher.
He was a good bridge player, and I was just a novice, as I still am. We played in the evening. We played for very small stakes, and if he found a good partner, he generally hung on to the good partner, and the aide generally got the bad partner. But on one occasion, General Al Grunther, who was then chief of staff to General Clark, and General Eich were partners in this bridge game in a tent. And Clark and I, who were freewheelers, were the opponents. And Al Grunther was so good a bridge player that he was the referee at the Whist Club in New York when he was an instructor at West Point. And Eich was good, particularly at mathematics, and he could tell you about where all 52 cards were when the bidding was finished. But these fellows liked to psych us. But the one occasion, they psyched to one another. They made some extravagant bids, and we'd give them a double, and they came tumbling down, all because they were trying to mislead us, but were misleading one another.
And the famous Eisenhower temper.
He had the temper. He expressed himself very vehemently at times, but this was good for him. It got it out of his system. Once he got angry with me publicly about something that miscarried in the way of a car. The car had been ordered to another exit from the hotel, and I was Ike hopped on to me. I wasn't in charge of the car. One of my compatriots was doing that. So when we got back to the villa, I said, I resign as your aide. And he looked at me and says, who the hell ever called you an aide? Well, that was the end of the argument. I didn't resign anymore.
Now, the Allies were pushing the Germans across France, driving toward Germany itself. And the question of Paris. Historian Stephen Ambrose, author of The Supreme Commander.
What Ike wanted to do was to bypass Paris and leave it in German hands. First of all, because he wanted to fight a battle for it. He was keenly conscious, incidentally, and parenthetically here, of the cultural and historic monuments of Europe, and had very stern orders to all of his army commanders to do, and especially the airmen, to do everything possible to avoid the destruction of any of the cultural monuments that would be in the path of the advancing armies. And those orders were pretty well obeyed. Okay, so he felt strongly that he didn't want to fight any battles for Paris. One. Two, his biggest problem then, as really always until Antwerp was fully operating, was he just didn't have enough port capacity to supply the advancing troops. And he wanted to keep, this is August of 44, and the Germans were on the run, and he wanted to keep the pressure on them. But to do that, he needed supplies, especially gasoline, but everything else too, to keep the troops going. The problem with Paris was, Paris required, I can't remember offhand the figures, he had it worked out, but something like, the figure 200 tons a day sticks in my mind, for the minimum requirements of the city to keep people alive. So that if the Allies took Paris, two things would happen. One, they would have to take on the burden of supplying Paris from their already very limited port capacity. And two, you would relieve the Germans of the onerous duty of doing it. So his plans were to cross the Seine above and below Paris, but to leave the city itself in German hands.
The general wanted to go out and tour the Falaise Gap area, Argentan and other towns in that area. And while we were doing this one day, we went through the little town of Argentan, and out on a blackboard, as if they were advertising what the specials of the day at a restaurant or something of the sort, here was it chalked on the blackboard, Paris est libre. And sure enough, it was. That's how we found out about it, by this blackboard. Now, how in the world they found out about it, I suppose they got it by an underground radio. When we got back to camp, we found out that this had happened. And the reason it was so dumbfounding to us is we'd been briefed that we weren't going to go into Paris. But General de Gaulle and General Leclerc had other ideas, and actually they made up their own mind to go in and did it unilaterally.
People who forced his hand were not de Gaulle and the people around him. It was the resistance within Paris. And from what I can gather, they simply decided they didn't want Paris to be liberated from the outside. They wanted to liberate it from the inside themselves. They had been building up all through the war for this climactic moment. The only thing that held them back was there's not much point in liberating the city if you're not going to have Allied troops coming in soon thereafter. As soon as the Allied armies got close enough to Paris that if the city was liberated, then the Allies could move right into it, they moved, and thus forced Eisenhower's hand. And yeah, he was mad.
I had the unhappy task of going over to General Ike's trailer and telling him what had happened. And this was the only time during the whole time that I was with him that I saw him really angry.
With the liberation of Paris, the Battle of France was over. It had lasted 80 days. They had been costly in terms of lives for both the advancing Allies and the stubbornly resistant Germans. By mid-September, Allied forces had at one point punched through to the German border, and the Germans dug in to fight for the fatherland. For Ike, it was a time of strategic and tactical decisions. Harry Butcher.
He had decisions to make every day of the war, and I suppose several big ones every week. And one of the Sunday school hour on Sundays, where most everybody else would be in Sunday school or in church, General Ike would meet with a judge advocate general and would go over with him the courts martial of the week. And here Ike had to decide what should be done. Should the court-martial be upheld? Should it be reviewed? Should it be set aside, etc.? Some cases were involved death penalty, and those had to be sent back to Washington. That was the worst time. We'd ride home after, for Sunday lunch, and he would be real glum. This was a tough time.
By early December of 1944, the Allied line stretched from between Belgium and the Netherlands on the north, south along the edge of Germany to Switzerland. But on the morning of December 16th, Hitler sprang his surprise, a counterattack in the Ardennes forest region of France. It began with a thunderous sound of German tanks under the cover of fog and heavy clouds. Two panzer armies drove a wedge in the Allied lines. Behind the tanks came German infantry, aided by the bad weather, which kept Allied air power grounded. The German armies began to wheel to the right toward Antwerp. The Germans called it Operation Watch on the Rhine. It was better known as the Battle of the Bulge. It caught the Allies in their weakest area, and General Eisenhower had a full-scale German counterattack on his hands. Harry Butcher.
Ike was not surprised. In fact, he had said before that this is the weakest part of the line. We can't control all the line solidly because we've got a tremendous front. And so had the Germans. He said it's possible for either of us to build up strength at any given point and go pushing through if we want to. And that's what happened in the Battle of Ardennes. We didn't know it at the time, but Hitler had massed all the forces he could spare, and some he couldn't spare, to try to get through at one point, to try to demoralize us. I remember at the meeting of his principal subordinates up front, when some of them, the corps commanders and the army commanders and Ike, he says, I don't want any solemn faces.
His first reaction was strongly positive, that this was the best possible thing that could happen. He had been looking forward rather gloomily to a long winter in which he'd be building up his supplies, carrying out limited offensives, but not doing very much to get the job done. And suddenly, as he himself put it on the first meeting of his senior commanders after the bulge began, they've come out of their holes, and now we've got a chance to get them. And he took that attitude throughout. This meeting, incidentally, took place in an old barracks room of the French army at Verdun. And just think about Verdun, what it means, the greatest land battle of all history, the highest casualties and so on. And sitting here in Verdun in this old French barracks that was at least 200 years old, in a gloomy room with a pot-bellied stove, Eisenhower sat down with Bradley and Smith and Freddie de Guingamp, who was Montgomery's chief of staff, and Patton and Hodges and Simpson. And they all sat down, and the whole atmosphere of the place and the fact that the Germans had indeed surprised the Allies so much with, first of all, the attack itself, and second, the strength of the attack. Everybody was sitting around in a very gloomy frame of mind. Eisenhower looked around and said, there will only be smiles at this table. And Patton picked up on that right away and said, hell, Ike, let the go all the way to the channel, and then we can really chop them up and cut them off. And Eisenhower thought he wouldn't let him go quite that far, but that he agreed with the spirit.
And he ordered General Patton to come up with his forces, and Patton moved with characteristic speed and got there at Bastogne and saved the day, ultimately. But that's not to say others didn't do a terrific job, too. General Bradley and his forces momentarily put under command of General Montgomery, Field Marshal Montgomery, who in turn, Field Marshal Montgomery sort of emerged as a hero in that affair. But a British briefing officer said at our Scribe Hotel press conference that at the time of the German breakthrough in the Ardennes, Montgomery, whose forces were on the north side of it, along Antwerp and Holland, had a whole corps marching in the other direction. So little did he know about it, you see.
In a lot of ways, as a tactical general, that's where he came into his own. Up to that time,
It's probably fair to say that he had been letting a combination of his own staff officers, led by Beetle Smith, plus Patton, plus Bradley, plus Montgomery, push him around. And the biggest complaint about Eisenhower's generalship was that he went first one way and then another, depending on who he had talked to last. Alan Brooke used to make this criticism. And with some modifications, that charge is true for the first 5 months of campaigning in France. It was at the bulge that Eisenhower's self-confidence really peaked. And he took immediate charge of the situation, began moving around armies on his own, took two armies away from Bradley and gave them to Montgomery because it seemed to him the reasonable thing to do over Bradley's great protest, and it was the first time he'd ever really crossed Bradley. It was Eisenhower who decided to hold at Bastogne that this was the key road center and it had to be held. My favorite scene from this came about 3 days after the attack began. Eisenhower was poring over a map with his staff officers, and they were all making suggestions, and he just rapped on the table and asked for quiet. He said, "Now, boys, I'll tell you what we're going to do." And he sketched out the movement of about five armies on the thing, on the map, and just had total command of the situation. And from that point until May 8th, when the Germans surrendered, that was the general that Eisenhower was. He told the boys what to do.
On December 23rd, the weather broke, and the American air power joined the battle. Within 2 weeks, the Germans had been turned back. The Allies were again on the offensive, and Hitler had had his dying gasp. During that period, General Eisenhower received his fifth star, General of the Army. Only one man in American history ever attained higher military rank, General John Pershing. As the Allies marched into Germany now, Eisenhower made a decision that has been criticized perhaps more than any other he ever made. He decided to halt the Allies' advance into Germany at the Elbe River, some 60 miles west of Berlin. That let the Russians reach Berlin before the Allies. Harry Butcher.
That was a decision that later was highly criticized by lots of people who don't really or didn't really know all the circumstances. The basic circumstance that should be borne in mind is that the directive of the combined chiefs of staff, which was the British and the American chiefs of staff with headquarters in Washington, their directive to the supreme commander, Allied supreme commander of Scheife, was that he lead the forces to the destruction of the heart of Germany. General Eich construed the heart of Germany, as did his associates, on the military level at least, as the industrial heart of the country, where in the Ruhr Valley, where there was the coal and the iron and the steel and the materiel flowed to make the tanks and the guns. And when General Eich had encircled that, his forces. This was the end of the war so far as the ability of the Germans to continue. General Eich thought with respect to crossing the Elbe that it would cost 5,000 American lives to get into Berlin. The Russians were already fighting in Berlin, block by block. We would have great difficulty controlling and keeping our armed forces separate from the Russians. They might conceivably end up fighting one another accidentally. And Eich did not think it was worth 5,000 lives to get into Berlin, which he always regarded as having been pummeled into military really graveyard. But of course, politically, Berlin was a place on the map, and it's lots of GIs. Had on their tanks, had on their vehicles, all the way from North Africa through France, Berlin or bust. Then many of them didn't get there, and they didn't like it.
He did it in the face of opposition from Patton, Simpson, not so much Hodges, Montgomery, and most importantly, Churchill. And that latter group were all furious and thought he had made a dreadful mistake. His primary reason was simple military possibilities. In a way, he almost took the attitude that these political arguments that we're having as to the importance of Berlin and should we take it or should the Russians take it are all very interesting,
But the reality situation is such that there is no possibility of our getting to Berlin before the Russians, so why should we try? Eisenhower's second reason was political, that what difference did it make if the West or the East captured Berlin, since the lines of division in Germany as a whole for zones of occupation, and in Berlin in particular, had already been agreed to, formal agreements between heads of government. Nobody had any intention of cheating on these. Even Churchill, who was the strongest advocate of Western troops taking Berlin, gave as his justification only that it would be good for Western prestige. Eisenhower felt there wasn't much point in losing men's lives for purposes of national prestige.
As the Allied armies poured into Germany and the Russians squeezed in from the east, the German army all but collapsed. On April 30th, Hitler killed himself. The Nazi era ended. Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz became head of the Reich, and a surrender to General Eisenhower was arranged to take place at Reims. On May 7th, General Gustav Jodl and Admiral Hans von Friedenberg, representing Dönitz, signed that surrender. Harry Butcher recalls it.
I elected not to take the surrender himself. He signed that to his chief of staff, Edel Smith. And after the signatures, the German generals were received. He asked them if they understood what they had signed, that this was unconditional surrender, and they answered yes. And then they were dismissed. That was it.
General Bradley got the word directly from Ike by phone.
At that time, we were way up in Germany, and we'd connected, had joined up with the Russians at the Elbe, and there were just a few Germans left in between. They had no fighting ability left, so it was bound to come very soon. I got a call about 4 o'clock in the morning, and Ike on the phone himself, and said, "Oh, Brad, it's all over." And went on to tell me they'd signed an armistice that day, effective at midnight the next day. And so I immediately called all their army commanders and passed the word on to them to stop all operations so there'd be no more casualties. No use to take any more losses as long as we'd won. And that was done between 4 o'clock and 6, as I called all the commanders. It only took a few minutes because I had direct connection with all of them. And that was it.
For General Eisenhower, the surrender brought not so much elation as fatigue. The job was over.
We were so now anticipating the thing, it was a letdown, really. There was no celebration in my headquarters whatsoever. It was 2:30 in the morning. I was so tired, I would have gotten in bed with a wildcat. I was just worn out, and I think everybody in the whole place was. Then the next day, we had to work. We had a lot of work to do. We were working like dogs, you know, so we never did get a chance to celebrate. It was with real relief, really, that's what it was.
There was one last piece of business to be done that early morning by the Supreme Commander, to draft a message to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, telling them of the German surrender. Harry Butcher and his staff set to work on an eloquent communique, but Ike himself wrote it. The message officially notifying the surrender of Nazi Germany, the climax of what Roosevelt had termed the mighty endeavor, read simply, "The mission of this Allied force was fulfilled at 0241 local time, March 7th, 1945. General Ike's war was over.
The Eisenhower Years, produced by Extension Radio Television at Kansas State University on a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The producer-narrator is Ralph Titus. Research by Anne Frank. Music for the Eisenhower Years was composed by Gail Kubik, performed by the Kansas State University Chamber Symphony, conducted by Luther Levengood. Our thanks to the following for materials used in this week's broadcast: National Educational Television, CBS News, and Metro Media Radio. Next week, the transition, the post-war years. This is Paul DeWeese.